primary beneficiaries were the countries in the region, according to Kushner. His worry was increased Iranian influence and subversive operations in the region, especially Hezbollah, which threatened Israel. "Get the Saudis to buy more," Kushner said. "If they bought weapons systems, it would help the U.S. economy and job creation. They would buy large stockpiles of munitions, 10-year maintenance and support contracts." The Saudi team came back to Washington for a second visit. For at least 4 days straight, they all had meetings that went to 1 a.m. Kushner held daily interagency meetings of the key U.S. players in his office, where a dozen people crowded in. At times, the Saudis were not delivering enough on contracts or arms purchases. "I'll make a phone call," Kushner said to Harvey. He phoned MBS directly, and the Saudis increased their arms purchases. When it looked like they were close, Kushner invited MBS to the United States and brought him to the White House, where he had lunch March 14th in the state dining room with Trump. Attending were Pence, Priebus, Bannon, McMaster, and Kushner. This violated protocol, unsettling officials at state and the CIA. Lunch at the White House with the president for a middle-rank deputy crown prince was just not supposed to be done. Tillerson and Mattis continued to express their doubts. "This is too hard, too much work to do, too many questions about the contracts." Trump finally gave the go-ahead, and the trip to both Saudi Arabia and Israel was announced on Thursday, May 4th. Trump went to Saudi Arabia from May 20th to 21st and was lavishly welcomed. He announced $110 billion in Saudi-funded defense purchases and a grab bag of several hundred billion in other contracts, certainly an exaggerated number. Harvey believed the summit had reset the relationships in a dramatic way, a home run, sending a strategic message to Iran, the principal adversary. The Saudis, the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, and Israel were united. The Obama approach of straddling was over. The next month, Saudi King Salman, at age 81, appointed MBS, age 31, the new crown prince and next in line to lead the kingdom, perhaps for decades to come. Chapter 15. Trump was one of the most outspoken foes of the 16-year-old Afghanistan war, now the longest in American history. To the extent Trump had a bedrock principle, it was opposition, even ridicule, of the war. Beginning in 2011, 4 years before his formal entry into the presidential race, he launched a drumbeat of Twitter attacks. In March 2012, he tweeted, "Afghanistan is a total disaster. We don't know what we are doing. They are, in addition to everything else, robbing us blind." In 2013, the tweets picked up. In January, it was, "Let's get out of Afghanistan. Our troops are being killed by the Afghanis we train, and we waste billions there. Nonsense. Rebuild the USA." In March, "We should leave Afghanistan immediately. No more wasted lives. If we have to go back in, we go in hard and quick. Rebuild the U.S. first." In April, "Our government is so pathetic that some of the billions being wasted in Afghanistan are ending up with terrorists." And in November, "Do not allow our very stupid leaders to sign a deal that keeps us in Afghanistan through 2024, with all costs by USA. Make America great." And in December 2015, Trump tweeted, "A suicide bomber has just killed U.S. troops in Afghanistan. When will our leaders get tough and smart? We are being led to slaughter." Like all presidents, Trump was living with the unfinished business of his predecessors. In the 21st century presidency, nothing illustrated this more clearly than Afghanistan. The war, begun after the 9/11 terrorist attacks when Afghanistan had been the sanctuary for Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, was a thicket of high expectations, setbacks, misunderstandings, and massive commitments of money, troops, and lives. Under Presidents Bush and Obama, debates and discussions of troop numbers had dominated internal NSC and public discussion and generated expectations of progress or resolution. Media coverage focused on the troop number and timetable storylines. The number of U.S. troops engaged in the war had become a proxy for progress. During the Obama presidency, troop numbers were a roller coaster, peaking at 100,000 and dropping to 8,400 with heady expectations later abandoned that the combat mission against the insurgent Taliban could end. But internally, the experts knew it was futile. White House Coordinator Lieutenant General Douglas Lute labeled the war a house of cards in a 2010 meeting soon after Obama added another 30,000 troops. Dr. Peter Lavoie, Obama's Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asian and Pacific Security Affairs, later in charge of South Asia for the Obama NSC staff, was a soft-spoken authority on South Asia, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Lavoie was largely unknown to the public, but critical to the functioning of the defense and intelligence world. He was both academic and practitioner. He believed the obsession with U.S. troop numbers had been the Achilles heel of the Obama administration policy in Afghanistan. "There are literally thousands of sub-tribes in Afghanistan," Lavoie said. "Each has a grievance. If the Taliban ceased to exist, you would still have an insurgency in Afghanistan." Victory was far-fetched. Winning had not been defined. H.R. McMaster saw he would have a major confrontation with President Trump on the Afghanistan war. He knew Afghanistan. From 2010 to 2012, he had served as the deputy to the Commander for Planning, J5, at the Afghanistan War Commander's headquarters in Kabul. During the Gulf War in 1991 in Operation Desert Storm, just 7 years out of West Point as an Army captain, McMaster led 9 tanks in a battle that destroyed 28 Iraqi Republican Guard tanks. Captain McMaster suffered no losses, and the battle lasted 23 minutes. He was awarded a Silver Star for valor. In the Iraq War, as a colonel, he led 5,300 soldiers of the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, successfully using protect-the-population counter-insurgency tactics to reclaim the city of Tal Afar in 2005. President Bush had publicly cited it as a model operation to give reason for hope for a free Iraq. In McMaster's 1997 book, Dereliction of Duty, he called the Joint Chiefs who oversaw the Vietnam War 5 silent men who had failed to establish the essential personal rapport with civilian leaders so they could speak their minds. Dereliction of Duty was a field manual for avoiding another Vietnam. The irony was that Trump was now saying that Afghanistan was Vietnam, a quagmire with no clear national security purpose, the latest example of the incoherence of American policy. McMaster's job was to align the military's recommendations for Afghanistan with the president's goals. But this president's only goal was to get out. Staff work at the NSC ground on. On March 1st and 10th, 2017, Army Ranger Lieutenant Colonel Fernando Luján, the National Security Council staffer for Afghanistan, chaired the first middle-level meetings of the interagency in the Trump administration. It included representatives from the State Department, Pentagon, and the intelligence agencies. Luján, a holdover from the Obama administration, knew the Afghanistan policy under Obama had been simple in practice: avoid catastrophe. There was lots of uncertainty, and the possibilities of calamity were immense. He gave the Afghan police, for example, key to long-term stability, a D- or F. At the first meeting, a State Department official teed up the discussion with a series of fundamental questions. Why do we think we need a counter-terrorist base in Afghanistan to prevent another attack? What's the justification for it? What do we think the terrorist threat emanating from Afghanistan really is? Why do we think thousands of U.S. troops and intelligence specialists are needed to combat that when we have drones and everything else? Our enduring presence, he noted, can cause further instability from not only insurgents, but also regional players such as Pakistan. The state official said the United States maintained it did not want to establish a permanent presence when it invaded Afghanistan in 2001. So how do we square that now, after 16 years? No, 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 said the military representative. The U.S. presence was not to be permanent. This led to the question, when might it all end? Was a political settlement possible? Would a political settlement be the ends or the means? How could a political settlement be possible if the insurgent Taliban did not want the United States to have any kind of a presence in Afghanistan? Could a possible political settlement be a way to sell continued engagement? If a political settlement became a top priority, that would require compromise. Was President Trump willing to do so? Was all of this a fig leaf so the United States could continue doing what it wanted to do? Was a democratic or stable government needed in Afghanistan? How invested was the U.S. in a real political settlement? Another State Department representative noted that the central government lacked legitimacy in the eyes of the Afghan public, the lowest in 10 years, according to polling done in the country. He observed that the illicit economy, opium and illegal mining, was the size of the regular economy, and a significant portion was under control of Taliban insurgents. After 9/11, the CIA and military had paid off the Afghan warlords to go after the Taliban. Some of that money had been used to target political opposition. Now the U.S. was spending about $50 billion a year in Afghanistan. Was the government, which was deeply corrupt, just taking money from the U.S. and the allies to fund themselves? Was the large level of assistance taking away the Afghan government's incentive to develop real reforms and the political will to take on opium and profits from mining? American money was one of the poisons in the Afghan system. A larger question loomed. Should the United States be playing to win in Afghanistan, or merely not to lose? After one meeting, they took whiteboards and broke into three groups to attempt to define the problem and state vital strategic objectives. Common to all three was the goal of preventing further attacks on the homeland. They raised additional questions. What kind of government did Afghanistan need? And what kind of stability did the U.S. need to achieve the goal of preventing further terrorist attacks? Initially, in meetings with representatives from the Pentagon, State Department, and the intelligence agencies, McMaster laid out his four frames or goals. 1. Achieve political stability that will include a political settlement with the insurgent Taliban. 2. Push for institutional actions by the Afghan government to counter the Taliban. 3. Increase pressure on neighboring Pakistan, which was playing a double game, nominally allied with the United States, but also supporting terrorists and the Taliban. 4. Maintain international support from the 39 countries allied with the United States in a coalition. Casting about for a middle ground on more troops, McMaster considered a proposal for adding thousands more, perhaps 3,000 to 5,000, to prevent another terrorist attack. One staff proposal called for thinking about eventually adding tens of thousands. At a principals' committee meeting, so-called because unlike an NSC meeting, the principals meet without the president, Attorney General Sessions erupted at everyone, including McMaster, over the idea of more troops. You're basically walking the president into exactly what he doesn't believe in, to a place he doesn't want to go, Sessions said. We're losing too many lives in Afghanistan. I don't understand what you guys don't get. This is not where the president's at. Priebus said, "You have not spent the time working with the president on what his basic philosophy and foreign policy positions are and why." With the president, he said, "Why is the most important part? Why are we here? Why are we doing this? What do you want to happen? And what exactly are we trying to accomplish?" This was precisely the question that Peter Lavoie had been asking in the Obama administration. Neither Priebus nor Lavoie received a satisfactory answer. The principal's consensus settled on adding up to 4,000 troops. "Has anyone told the president," Priebus asked, "that the option you're choosing basically says we're going to be in Afghanistan for decades? If you explain it to him, he's going to go crazy. Who's talking to him about these details?" Silence. Afterward, Priebus called a meeting of the key players. "Look," he said, "we've got a problem. We are not connecting with the president over the more basic issues. Why do you want to be there? What is the purpose? What is the fundamental value to the United States for risking American lives? You have to come to a fundamental understanding and agreement on those basic issues before you start talking about how many troops are we going to have in Afghanistan. You guys are like 10 steps ahead of yourselves." It was not enough for McMaster to declare the objective was to prevent another terrorist attack. The question was simple. How would several thousand more troops help to achieve that? There were four missions in Afghanistan: train and advise the Afghan army and police, logistical support, counterterrorism, and the intelligence mission. McMaster had to craft a strategy that avoided escalation or the appearance of escalation. It could not directly or brazenly challenge Trump's stated desire to get out, but had to softly market a new approach that soon would be called Stay the Course. On March 28th, McMaster proposed what became known to the NSC staff as the R4s: reinforce, realign, reconcile, and regionalize. These were the components of the Afghanistan strategy he was proposing, and they fit neatly within his concept of four frames. Reinforcing meant more equipment and training. Realigning meant targeting funding for areas under control of the Afghan government rather than contested areas held by the Taliban. Reconciling meant trying to get the Afghan government to be inclusive, hold elections, and work with power brokers. And regionalizing meant the U.S. working with regional actors such as India. By May, the proposed plan had settled on the middle ground of adding 3,000 to 5,000 more troops. Some would come in off the books, meaning they would not be counted in official public numbers. The plan would be counterterrorism-centric. An aviation battalion would be available to help the Afghan army when they were in a serious fight with the Taliban. The rules of engagement were being altered. Previously, U.S. forces could only use force if they were threatened. Now they could be used when the Afghan army was threatened. Around the same time, Senator Lindsey Graham was pushing Trump for more troops. Graham and Trump had three conversations about Afghanistan in May. "Do you want on your resume that you allowed Afghanistan to go back into the darkness and the second 9/11 came from the very place the first 9/11 did?" Graham asked. It mirrored his argument to Trump about North Korea. "Well," Trump asked, "how does this end?" "It never ends," Graham said. "It's good versus evil. Good versus evil never ends. It's just like the Nazis. It's now radical Islam. It will be something else one day. So our goal is to make sure the homeland never gets attacked from Afghanistan. Look at the thousands of extra troops as an insurance policy against another 9/11. Listen to your generals." Graham landed on a metaphor that he knew Trump would love. General Obama was terrible. General Biden was terrible. General Susan Rice was awful. General Valerie Jarrett. But General Trump is going to be no better. General Graham is not better. Listen to your generals or fire them. At one point, Vice President Pence called Graham to say, "You've got to tell him how this ends." "It would never end," Graham repeated. Graham was aware of the internal warfare in the White House. General Kellogg, NSC Chief of Staff, was siding with Bannon, arguing to get out. That meant Kellogg was at war with McMaster, his own boss. Graham saw the stories Bannon or someone else was leaking to the press, calling this McMaster's war. He called Trump at once. "This is Trump's war, my friend," Graham told the president. "Nobody in history is going to remember McMaster or Bannon. They're going to remember you." In Bannon's eyes, the old order would do what it always did: stay the course or retreat in disgrace. He wanted to find a way to mitigate the downside risk, providing cover for Trump. In a May 31st op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, Eric Prince, the founder of the controversial defense contractor Blackwater, declared, "Afghanistan is an expensive disaster for America." He proposed the creation of a viceroy to lead all military efforts in Afghanistan and the replacement of all but a small special operations command of the U.S. military with cheaper private solutions, contractors who would make multi-year commitments to train the Afghan security forces. The U.S. should adjust course from the past 15-plus years of nation-building and focus on pounding the Taliban and other terrorists so hard that they plead for negotiation. Until they feel real pressure and know the U.S. has staying power, they will win. This did not get very far because it meant private contractors like Prince, a brother of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, would make lots of money. Bannon asked CIA Director Mike Pompeo if he could find a middle solution. Pompeo agreed to go to Afghanistan in the first week of August. For years, the CIA had run a 3,000-man top-secret covert army in Afghanistan. The CTPT, short for Counterterrorism Pursuit Teams, were Afghans paid, trained, and controlled by the CIA. They were the best Afghan fighters, the cream of the crop. They killed or captured Taliban insurgents and often went into tribal areas to eliminate them. They conducted dangerous and highly controversial cross-border operations into neighboring Pakistan. Could this CIA paramilitary force be expanded, making a troop increase unnecessary? Could the CIA paramilitary force and several thousand Army Special Forces do the job so the big regular ground force of the U.S. Army could get out? Mattis called Senator Graham. A proposal was forthcoming, he explained. The military would coordinate with the CIA. The CIA has got some high-value targets that they want to hit. There were four operations, two on either side of the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. When McMaster tried to sell a slimmed-down version of concepts like frames or the R4s, Trump was cruelly dismissive. He had one question: what the fuck are we doing there? But he had an idea for Secretary Mattis and Bannon. "I want to get some enlisted guys, some real fighters over here who are not officers." He wanted their on-the-ground views of Afghanistan. Mattis rolled his eyes. Bannon, always looking to history to serve his purposes, was reminded of President Lincoln's almost mystical devotion to hearing from soldiers as commander-in-chief. On July 18th, Trump had lunch at the White House with three soldiers and an airman who had served in Afghanistan. Trump, Pence, and McMaster sat on one side of the wide, gleaming table in the Roosevelt Room. On the other side sat the four young men in their dress uniforms, looking uncomfortable as cameras documented their visit. The president said, "I want to find out why we've been there 17 years, how it's going, and what we should do in terms of additional ideas. We have plenty of ideas from a lot of people, but I want to hear it from people on the ground." Afterward, Trump summed up their views for Bannon. "Unanimous. We've got to figure out how to get the fuck out of there. Totally corrupt. The people are not worth fighting for. NATO does nothing. They're a hindrance. Don't let anybody tell you how great they are. It's all bullshit. The National Security Council gathered in the Situation Room at 10 o'clock the next morning, July 19th, to brief Trump on the Afghanistan and Pakistan strategy. McMaster spent the initial part of the meeting identifying objectives and framing issues for discussion. Trump looked bored and seemed disengaged. After about 5 minutes, he interrupted. "I've been hearing about this nonsense about Afghanistan for 17 years with no success," he said, before McMaster had finished laying out the issues. "We've got a bunch of inconsistent short-term strategies. We can't continue with the same old strategy." He brought up his meeting with the troops the previous day. "The best information I've gotten was from a couple of those line soldiers, not the generals," he said. "I don't care about you guys," he told Mattis, Dunford, and McMaster. "We're losing big in Afghanistan. It's a disaster. Our allies aren't helping. Ghost soldiers, those paid but not serving, are ripping us off." "NATO is a disaster and a waste," he said. The soldiers had told him that NATO staff were totally dysfunctional. "Pakistan isn't helping us. They're not really a friend, despite the $1.3 billion a year in aid the U.S. gave them." He said he refused to send any additional aid. "The Afghan leaders were corrupt and making money off the United States," he insisted. "The poppy fields, largely in Taliban territory, are out of control." "The soldiers on the ground could run things much better than you," the president told his generals and advisors. "They could do a much better job. I don't know what the hell we're doing." It was a 25-minute dressing down of the generals and senior officials. "Look, you can't think of Afghanistan in isolation," Tillerson said. "You've got to think about it in a regional context. We've never before taken this sort of multilateral approach to Afghanistan and the region." "But how many more deaths?" Trump asked. "How many more lost limbs? How much longer are we going to be there?" His anti-war argument, practically ripped from a Bob Dylan song lyric, reflected the desires of his political base, whose families were overrepresented in the military forces. "The quickest way out is to lose," Mattis said. Trump pivoted. "Prime Minister Modi of India is a friend of mine," he said. "I like him very much. He told me the U.S. has gotten nothing out of Afghanistan. Nothing. Afghanistan has massive mineral wealth. We don't take it like others, like China. The U.S. needed to get some of Afghanistan's valuable minerals in exchange for any support." "I'm not making a deal on anything until we get minerals. And the U.S. must stop payments to Pakistan until they cooperate." Mattis described their strategic framework and goals for nuclear non-proliferation. "We need a bridge strategy until we're able to empower the Afghans," he said. "Why can't we pay mercenaries to do the work for us?" Trump asked. "We need to know if the commander-in-chief is fully with us or not," Mattis said. "We can't fight a half-assed war anymore." In order for the military to succeed, Mattis needed Trump to be all in on the strategy. "I'm tired of hearing that we have to do this or that to protect our homeland or to ensure our national security," Trump said. The official full written NSC record of the meeting said simply that Trump endorsed the use of a mix of tools to pressure Pakistan to abandon its covert support of the Taliban. Contrary to his words, the document stated the U.S. would continue to engage Pakistan where there were mutual interests, and civil assistance to Pakistan would continue while military assistance would be conditioned on better behavior. Rhetorically and operationally, it would be a new, get-tough strategy. Later in the day, those who had been in the meeting huddled in Priebus's office to discuss Afghanistan and South Asia strategy. McMaster worked to frame things in a way that showed he had heard the president's views and was trying to execute on the general orientation of them in as responsible a manner as possible. He tried to be upbeat, but it was clear that he, Mattis, and Tillerson were close to their wits' ends. That evening, Priebus hosted a dinner strategy meeting. Bannon seemed to be driving the agenda. Priebus, Bannon, and Stephen Miller, a young, hardline policy advisor and speechwriter who had previously been Jeff Sessions' communications director, complained about the NSC process. McMaster didn't seem to want to implement the president's viewpoints, but was trying to convince Trump of his own. Bannon wanted to replace McMaster with Kellogg, the NSC chief of staff, whose worldview aligned more closely with the president's and his own. Graham told Trump that Ashraf Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, would allow him to have as many counterterrorism troops as he could want, plus CIA bases wherever he wanted. It was the best listening post and platform to attack international terrorism in the world. "They would take 100,000 troops," Graham said, exaggerating. "You should jump for joy that you have a counterterrorism partner in Afghanistan, which will prevent the next 9/11. "That's not nation-building," Trump said. "We're not going over there to try to sell Jeffersonian democracy," Graham agreed. His worry was the increasing, endless tension between Pakistan and India. "Pakistan is spending a lot of money to build more nuclear weapons. It's getting really out of control." Graham had recently visited Afghanistan and left depressed. "We don't have a game plan in Afghanistan on the diplomatic side." There was no special representative, the role that had been filled by Richard Holbrooke in the first part of the Obama administration. "We don't even have an ambassador." For all he could tell, there was only one person at the State Department on the South Asia desk. "We're going to fail on the political," he said. "A peace settlement with the Taliban was the only way out. The Pakistanis are going to double deal until they see the Taliban losing." Trump had a solution. Did Graham want to be the ambassador to Pakistan? "No, I don't want to be ambassador to Pakistan," Graham said. They left it at that. At the White House, Trump began repeating a line he had heard at a meeting. "The way we're going to win is to run an insurgency against the insurgency of the Taliban." Trump loved the idea of a renegade operation, a campaign that the establishment was sure no one could win. The president said, "These guys in the 1980s against the Russians on horses? Perfect." Bannon added fuel to the renegade fire by criticizing the weak Afghan army. "We spent $1 trillion to take the world's best fighters," Bannon said, "and turn them into the world's worst army." Trump loved that also. Bannon had pushed about as far as he thought he could. They were trying to make policy on a string of one-sentence cliches. Graham had one more warning for Trump. "Pull them all out, because 8,600 troops ain't going to work, and accept the consequences," he warned Trump, referring to the number currently in Afghanistan. "And here are the consequences. It becomes Iraq on steroids. There are more international terrorists in Afghanistan than there ever were in Iraq. The deterioration will be quick, and the projection of terrorism coming from Afghanistan will exponentially grow, and the next 9/11 is coming from where the first 9/11 was, and you own it. The question is, are you going to go down the Obama road, which is to end the war and put us all at risk, or are you going to go down the road of stabilizing Afghanistan?" Chapter 16. "You've got to be kidding me," Priebus had told Secretary of State Tillerson in a phone call in early March. The controversial Iran deal negotiated by Obama had to be reviewed every 90 days. They now had 2 days to renew or reject, Tillerson said. In February, Trump had called it one of the worst deals I've ever seen. As a candidate in 2016, he had said, "My number one priority is to dismantle the disastrous deal with Iran." Tillerson wanted to renew as a matter of both practicality and principle. Central was the fact Iran was in compliance with the deal as Obama had negotiated it. He came up with some language for renewal. "The president's not going to go for it," Priebus said. "You need to come up with a better statement." mild, matter-of-fact won't cut it. We need language that's going to actually make the case for President Trump's position. He's not going to like it. Secondly, if he reads this, he's going to really blow up. When Priebus briefed Trump on Tillerson's proposal, the president retorted, "You aren't going to jam this down my throat." Priebus ran shuttle diplomacy between the president and the Secretary of State. "They're not in violation," Tillerson said. The intelligence community and the allies who were signatories to the deal agreed that Iran was not in violation. "Those arguments would not fly with the president," Priebus said. Tillerson held his ground. "We've got a problem then," Priebus said. He felt he had to remind Tillerson, "The president is the decision-maker here." He took himself off the hook. "I'm not trying to give you a hard time." Tillerson went to see the president. "This is one of my core principles," Trump said. "I'm not in favor of this deal. This is the worst deal that we have ever made, and here we are renewing this deal." Since it was only for 90 days, he would go along. "This is the last time. Don't come back to me and try to renew this thing again. There's going to be no more renewals. It's a shitty deal." Mattis found a diplomatic, quieter way to agree with Tillerson. "Well, Mr. President," Mattis said, "I think they are probably in technical compliance." Priebus watched in admiration. Mattis was not meek, but he sure knew how to handle Trump. Tillerson had to send a letter to Speaker Paul Ryan by April 18th. Trump didn't like the first draft. He directed that the short letter include that Iran was a leading state sponsor of terror and that the NSC would review whether to continue the suspension of economic sanctions that were part of the deal. When the letter was first released, television commentators pounded Trump. Watching this made him more upset. He ordered Tillerson to hold a press conference to denounce both the deal, which had just been renewed, and Iran. It was extraordinary to unleash an attack within hours of renewing a landmark diplomatic agreement. In a 5-minute presentation, Tillerson read a prepared list of all the grievances against Iran: ballistic missile testing, the world's leading sponsor of terrorism, threats to Israel, human rights violations, cyber attacks, arbitrary detention of foreigners, including U.S. citizens, harassing U.S. Navy ships, jailing or executing political opponents, reaching the agonizing low point of executing juveniles, and support to the brutal Assad regime in Syria. The Iran deal, Tillerson said, fails to achieve the objective of a non-nuclear Iran. It only delays their goal of becoming a nuclear state. Obama had defined the deal as a non-binding agreement rather than a treaty which requires Senate ratification. "Perhaps," Priebus said to Trump, "we can declare this a document that needs to be sent to the Senate for approval. Just take it out of our hands. Give it to the Senate and say, you pass it with 2/3 and declare it a treaty." Trump seemed intrigued, but soon understood he would be giving up authority by sending it to the Senate. He agreed that for the moment they were stuck with it. Only for the moment. Priebus and Tillerson and McMaster made sure they were calendaring, as they say in the White House, when the next 90-day renewal would come up. "They're in violation," Trump said in a meeting before the July 17th deadline, "and you need to figure out how the argument is going to be made to declare that." One day, Tillerson came to the dining room next to the Oval Office to see Trump and Priebus and explain to the president again that there was no violation. "They are in violation," Trump insisted, "and you should make the case that this agreement is done and finished." He suggested they might consider reopening the terms of the deal, and that maybe we'd be willing to renegotiate. "Mr. President," Tillerson said in exasperation, "you have the authority. You're the president. You just tell me what you want me to do. You call the shots. I'll do what you say." He was getting dangerously close to violating the protocols of dealing with a president. CIA Director Pompeo did not disagree with Tillerson's arguments on Iran and the reality of the Iran deal, but he, like Mattis, handled it more softly with the president. "Well, Mr. President, this is how I understand it works, technically." Mattis still saw Iran as the key destabilizing influence in the region. In private, he could be pretty hard-line, but he had mellowed. Push them back, screw with them, drive a wedge between the Russians and Iranians, but no war. Russia had privately warned Mattis that if there was a war in the Baltics, Russia would not hesitate to use tactical nuclear weapons against NATO. Mattis, with agreement from Dunford, began saying that Russia was an existential threat to the United States. Mattis had formed a close relationship with Tillerson. They tried to have lunch most weeks. Mattis's house was near the State Department, and several times Mattis told his staff, "I'll walk down and say hello to him." McMaster considered Mattis and Tillerson the team of two and found himself outside their orbit, which was exactly the way they wanted it. To complicate things, Tillerson was having rows with the White House over personnel for the State Department. Priebus called a meeting with Tillerson and half a dozen White House staffers on the patio outside the Chief of Staff's corner office. At one point, Tillerson had adamantly opposed the person suggested by the White House for a senior post, and he had hired his own person. Johnny DeStefano, the director of personnel for the White House, objected. Tillerson erupted. "No one's going to tell me who to hire and not to hire. When I got this job, I was told I got to hire my people." "You get to hire your people," Priebus said, intervening. "But the problem we've got here is that it's going so slowly. Number one, we're bogged down not having personnel where they need to be. Number two, it's making us look like fools. You need to either hire these people by the end of July, or I'm going to have to start picking people." Tillerson soon engaged in another fight, this time in the Oval Office and in front of the president. He belittled policy advisor Stephen Miller, a Trump favorite, charging he didn't know what he was talking about. "What did you ever really run?" he asked Miller condescendingly. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, who was a commander in the Naval Reserves, tried several times to persuade Mattis to appear on Sunday talk shows on behalf of the administration. The answer was always no. "Sean," Mattis finally said, "I've killed people for a living. If you call me again, I'm going to fucking send you to Afghanistan. Are we clear?" "I'm never signing one of these recertifications again," Trump said. "I can't believe I'm signing this one. There's no way you're going to get me to sign another one." McMaster later signed and put out a 27-page methodical Iran strategy with two prongs. The first was engagement, which was really a subversion campaign to influence Iran's population. The second was confrontation for their malign actions. Chapter 17. During the campaign, Trump had pounded almost as hard on U.S. trade agreements as he had on Hillary Clinton. As far as he was concerned, the current U.S. trade agreements allowed cheaper foreign goods to flood into the United States, which took away jobs from American workers. At a rally in June 2016 at a Pennsylvania scrap metal facility, he said the loss of industrial jobs was a politician-made disaster, and the consequence of a leadership class that worships globalism over Americanism. The result was that our politicians took away from the people their means of making a living and supporting their families, moving our jobs, our wealth, and our factories to Mexico and overseas. He blasted Clinton and her friends in global finance who want to scare America into thinking small. Nearly all economists disagreed with Trump, but he found an academic economist who hated free trade as much as he did. He brought him to the White House as both Director of Trade and Industrial Policy and Director of the National Trade Council. Peter Navarro was a 67-year-old Harvard PhD in economics. "This is the president's vision," Navarro publicly said. "My function really as an economist is to try to provide the underlying analytics that confirm his intuition. and his intuition is always right in these matters. Gary Cohn was convinced that trade deficits were irrelevant and could be a good thing, allowing Americans to buy cheaper goods. Goods from Mexico, Canada, and China were flooding into the United States because they were competitively priced. Americans who spent less money on those imported goods had more money to spend on other products, services, and savings. This was the efficiency of global markets. Cohn and Navarro clashed. At one meeting in the Oval Office with Trump and Navarro, Cohn said that 99.9999% of the world's economists agreed with him. It was basically true. Navarro stood virtually alone. Navarro took Cohn on, calling him a Wall Street establishment idiot. The core of Navarro's argument was that U.S. trade deficits were driven by high tariffs imposed by foreign countries like China, currency manipulation, intellectual property theft, sweatshop labor, and lax environmental controls. The North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, had sucked the manufacturing lifeblood out of the U.S. just as Trump predicted, Navarro said, turning Mexico into a manufacturing powerhouse while driving U.S. workers to the poorhouse. U.S. steel workers were being laid off and steel prices were dropping. Trump should impose tariffs on imported steel. Trump said he agreed. "If you just shut the fuck up and listen," Cohn said to both Trump and Navarro, dropping deference for the moment, "you might learn something." Goldman Sachs, to Cohn, had always been about research, data, and fact. Anytime you went into a meeting, you should have more hard, documented information than anyone else in the room. "The problem," Cohn said, "is that Peter comes in here and says all this stuff and doesn't have any facts to back it up. I have the facts." He had sent Trump a heavily researched paper on the service economy. He knew Trump had never read it and probably never would. Trump hated homework. "Mr. President," Cohn said, trying to summarize, "you have a Norman Rockwell view of America. The U.S. economy today is not that economy. Today, 80+% of our GDP is in the service sector." Cohn knew it was about 84%, but he did not want to be called out for rounding numbers up. The Goldman way was to carefully round down. "Think about it, sir. When you walk down a street in Manhattan today versus when you walked down a street in Manhattan 20 or 30 years ago." He chose a familiar intersection from memory. 20 years before, the Four Corners had been occupied by a Gap, a Banana Republic, J.P. Morgan, and a local retailer. Banana Republic and Gap don't really exist anymore, or they exist in the shadow of themselves. The local retailer doesn't exist. J.P. Morgan still exists. Now it's Starbucks, a nail salon, and J.P. Morgan. They're all service businesses. So when you walk down Madison Avenue today, or you walk down 3rd Avenue, or you walk 2nd Avenue, it's dry cleaners, it's food, it's restaurants, it's Starbucks, and it's nail salons. We no longer have ma-and-pa hardware stores. We don't have ma-and-pa clothing stores. Think of who you rent space to in Trump Tower. "I do have the largest Chinese bank as one of my major tenants," Trump said. "Who's your one retailer in the Trump Tower?" "Starbucks," Trump replied, "and a restaurant in the basement. Oh, and 2 more restaurants in the basement." "Exactly," Cohn said. "So your retail space today is services. It's not people selling shoes or hard goods or white goods. This is what America is today. So if we're 80+% services, if we spend less and less money on goods, we have more disposable income to spend on services, or do something miraculous called savings." Cohn found he almost had to shout to be heard. "Look," he said, "the only time that our trade deficit goes down were times like the financial crisis in 2008. Our trade deficit goes down because our economy's contracting. If you want our trade deficit to go down, we can make that happen. Let's just blow up the economy." "On the other hand," Cohn said, "if they did it his way, no tariffs, no quotas, no protectionism, no trade wars, if we do things right, our trade deficit's going to get bigger. And when the trade deficit got bigger each month, Cohn went to Trump, who grew more and more agitated. "Sir, I told you this was going to happen," Cohn said. "This is a good sign. It's not a bad sign." "I went to parts of Pennsylvania," the president said, "that used to be big steel towns, and now they're desolate towns, and no one had a job, and no one has work there." "That may be true, sir," Cohn said. "But remember, there were towns 100 years ago that made horse carriages and buggy whips. No one had a job either. They had to reinvent themselves. You go to states like Colorado, you've got 2.6 unemployment rate because they keep reinventing themselves." Trump did not like or buy any of the arguments. "It has nothing to do with it," Trump said. Cohn brought in Lawrence B. Lindsay, a Harvard economist who had held Cohn's job under President George W. Bush. Lindsay bluntly asked Trump, "Why are you spending any time thinking about our trade deficit? You should be thinking about the economy as a whole. If we can buy cheap products abroad and we can excel in other areas, service and high-tech products, that should be the focus. The global marketplace provided immense benefits to Americans." "Why don't we manufacture things at home?" Trump asked. "We're a manufacturing country." Of course, the United States manufactured things, but reality did not match the vision in Trump's mind. The president clung to an outdated view of America: locomotives, factories with huge smokestacks, workers busy on assembly lines. Cohn assembled every piece of economic data available to show that American workers did not aspire to work in assembly factories. Each month, Cohn brought Trump the latest job openings and labor turnover survey called JOLTS, conducted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He realized he was being an asshole by rubbing it in because each month was basically the same, but he didn't care. "Mr. President, can I show this to you?" Cohn fanned out the pages of data in front of the president. "See? The biggest leavers of jobs, people leaving voluntarily, was from manufacturing." "I don't get it," Trump said. Cohn tried to explain. "I can sit in a nice office with air conditioning and a desk, or stand on my feet 8 hours a day. Which would you do for the same pay?" Cohn added, "People don't want to stand in front of a 2,000-degree blast furnace. People don't want to go into coal mines and get black lung. For the same dollars or equal dollars, they're going to choose something else." Trump wasn't buying it. Several times, Cohn just asked the president, "Why do you have these views?" "I just do," Trump replied. "I've had these views for 30 years. "That doesn't mean they're right," Cohn said. "I had the view for 15 years I could play professional football. It doesn't mean I was right." Staff Secretary Rob Porter had been hired by Priebus. He came into the job with 5-star recommendations from people who had served as staff secretaries to Republican presidents. Priebus had required Porter almost to sign a blood oath of loyalty to him. "It's great you went to Harvard, Oxford, you're smart and everybody vouches for you, but what really matters to me is that you're going to be loyal to me." Porter had overlapped at Harvard with Jared Kushner, who had taken a class there taught by Porter's father, Roger Porter, who had served on the staffs of Presidents Ford, the first Bush, and Reagan. Jared and Porter met during the transition for about 2 hours. The first hour also seemed like a loyalty test. "Trump had great instincts and was a political genius," Kushner said, "but he was going to take some getting used to. You're going to have to learn how to handle him, how to relate to him." Though he had not been a Trump supporter during the 2016 campaign, Porter had accepted the job. By Inauguration Day, he had not yet met Trump. During the speech, Porter sat behind the podium and winced when Trump invoked "American carnage." He left 2/3 of the way through the speech so he could begin his duties and meet the new president. "I'm Rob Porter, Mr. President. I'm your staff secretary." It was clear Trump had no clue what that was or who Porter was. Jared told Trump that Porter was going to structure and order Trump's life. Trump looked at the two of them as if to say, "What are you talking about? You're not doing anything like that. No one's going to do that." The president walked away without saying anything to find a TV screen. The first official piece of paper for Trump to sign was the legislation granting retired Marine General James Mattis a waiver to become Secretary of Defense. Mattis had retired from the military less than the legally mandated 7 years before being permitted to serve as Secretary of Defense. Another matter was withdrawing the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, a regional free trade deal negotiated under Obama that lowered tariffs and provided a forum to resolve intellectual property and labor disputes between the U.S. and 11 other nations, including Japan, Canada, and numerous countries in Southeast Asia. During the transition, several people had told Trump that he didn't have to do it on day one. It was a little more complicated. It ought to be discussed. "No way, no how," Trump said. "This was on the campaign. We're not backing off this. We're signing it. Draw it up." He signed the papers to formally withdraw on January 23rd, the first full weekday of his presidency. The Trump trade agenda does indeed remain severely hobbled by political forces within the West Wing. Peter Navarro, the White House assistant heading the National Trade Council, wrote in an eyes-only two-page memo to the President and Chief of Staff Priebus on March 27, 2017. Navarro, who agreed with Trump's view that trade deficits mattered a great deal, was furious. He had been unable to get traction in the first 2 months of the Trump presidency. "It is impossible to get a trade action to your desk for consideration in a timely manner," Navarro wrote. He unleashed at Rob Porter, the staff secretary. "Any proposed executive action on trade that moves through the staff secretary process is highly vulnerable to dilution, delay, or derailment. Cohn has amassed a large power base in the West Wing, and his two top aides on trade are skilled political operatives fundamentally opposed to the Trump trade agenda. Not reported in the press is that Treasury Secretary Mnuchin is part of Cohn's Wall Street wing, which has effectively blocked or delayed every proposed action on trade." Navarro identified those fighting against the Cohn headwinds as Bannon, Stephen Miller, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and himself. "Mr. President, are you aware that under pressure from the Cohn faction, I was demoted on day one from assistant to deputy, given zero staff on trade, went almost 3 weeks without an office, and have had no direct access to the Oval Office?" Using an analogy sure to be understood by Trump, he said, "In golf terminology, I have been given only a 5-iron and a putter and ordered to shoot par on trade. An impossible task." He proposed that he and the National Trade Council be given more power, staff, and access. He included some news articles critical of Cohn and reporting on his increased power. Navarro handed the memo to Porter to be forwarded to Trump and Priebus. Porter was trying to present himself as the honest broker, but he had taught economics at Oxford and was convinced that Navarro's views were outdated and unsupportable. As far as Porter was concerned, Navarro was a member of the Flat Earth Society on trade deficits, like the president himself. Porter and Cohn had formed an alliance. The staff secretary was squarely a member of the Wall Street wing. At the same time, Porter saw clearly that Navarro represented the president's heart on trade. If he forwarded the memo, it could intensify the trade policy struggle and mushroom into a major fight. Porter showed the memo to Priebus. "This is a terrible idea," Porter said. "I'm not going to give it out. I'm going to keep it on my desk, keep it in my files, not going anywhere." Priebus didn't disagree. Porter again spoke with Priebus about trade. "We've got to do something about this," he said. "An absolute and complete mess, the Cohn-Mnuchin faction versus the Navarro-Ross faction. It's just a free-for-all. A melee, a sort of every-man-for-himself state of nature." "Well," Priebus said, "what do you think we ought to do? Somebody needs to coordinate trade. Who should it be? Priebus asked. In a normal administration, it would be the National Economic Council and Gary Cohn, Porter said.